Recording
for this,
in
I would
progress.
like to focus on the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Now, I've seen many have presented on this covenant already, but I would also like to bring our international perspective and hope that it will be helpful to provide you with some recommendations with regards to the bill. Now, South Africa has ratified this covenant on the 10th of December in 1998. It entered into force in 1999, and therefore South Africa is bound by this international document. Now, according to Section 39(1)(b) of the South African Constitution, when interpreting the Bill of Rights, the legislature must consider international law, and that is why we are bringing you today an international perspective on hate speech laws and what we have seen in the work that we have done across the globe. And that includes parts of Latin America, the US, Europe, and Africa. Now, Articles 19 and 20 of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, these are the articles that contain the right to freedom of opinion and expression. And I will focus on Article 20 here. Article 20 states, and I quote it, that in paragraph 2, any advocacy of national, racial, or religious hatred that constitutes incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence shall be prohibited by law. Now, just comparing this to the South African bill, we look here at the word constitutes. Now, the South African hate speech bill says that there should be a reasonable, that the speech should be reasonably construed or reasonably interpreted as such. Now, here in international law, the word constitutes is used, and that means that there must be a certainty with regards to the fact that there is incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence, and not a reasonable interpretation thereof. Furthermore, international law says that incitement must be present. It's not constitutes discrimination, hostility, or violence, but it must be incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. And in the South African bill, it says harm or incitement to harm. So there is an option with regards to incitement. And then finally, also, there's a definite list of forms of hatred that in international law, and that is discrimination, hostility, or violence. Now, these are clear areas, and contrary to what is written in the South African hate speech bill. Now, the hate speech bill in South Africa, harm is defined as substantial emotional, psychological, and social detriment. Now, as others have stated, these terms are open to subjective, novel, and ambiguous forms of harm, as well as the subjective offense of a person. Now, Article 20 and Article 19 of the ICCPR, in General Comment 34, the United Nations Human Rights Committee has stated that even if speech is deeply offensive, it does not mean that such speech needs to be limited by Articles 19, paragraph 3, and Article 20 of the ICCPR. Therefore, offensive speech is not necessarily limited. And this picture that you see here is a young man called Yahya Sharif Umino. And I would like to, you may ask me some questions later about this case, but this is a case that we have been involved in Nigeria. And this young man has been on death row for a number of years, and he is likely going to face the death penalty again. And the reason for that is because he sent a text message that was offending the Prophet Muhammad. And because of this offensive text message, he in Nigeria is now possibly facing the death penalty for a second time. And this is what broad laws look like in other countries in Africa, where they are being prosecuted for merely being deeply offensive. If you want to know more about this case, please feel free to ask it at the Q&A session. Furthermore, the specific bill has a very circular definition of hate. So Section 1 defines hate speech as saying see Section 4, Paragraph 1. Now, Section 4, Paragraph 1 states that hate speech is to promote or propagate hatred. Therefore, it's a circular argument where hate equals promoting or propagating hate without any definition of what hate means. Now, such a circular argument is contrary to what hate in Article 20 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights means, because even the United Nations' own interpretation of Article 20 of the ICCPR precludes this article of being used in such an overly broad circular manner. And I quote what the United Nations said. The special rapporteur said, Article 20 of the covenant was drafted against the historical background of the horrors committed by the Nazi regime during the Second World War. Therefore, a very high threshold to exist when Article 20 is being used to limit speech. The Rabat Plan of Action states that, and I quote, Article 20 of the covenant requires a high threshold because as a matter of fundamental principle, limitation of speech must remain an exception. This implies, among other things, that restrictions are clearly and narrowly defined and respond to a pressing social need, are the least intrusive measures available, are not overly broad so that they do not restrict speech in a wide or untargeted way, and are proportionate so that the benefit to the protected interest outweighs the harm to freedom of expression, including with respect to the sanctions they authorize. Therefore, we recommend that hate as defined in this bill, the notion of harm, are not clearly and narrowly defined, and they are not the least intrusive measures available with regards to speech that might be viewed as hateful. They are overly broad, and they restrict speech in a wide or untargeted way. Therefore, in general, this bill is contrary not only to the South African Constitution itself, but also to the international law covenant that was signed by South Africa and that came into action in 1999. We therefore recommend that South Africa, firstly, the South African Parliament reviews the bill in its entirety, and then also whether there is really need for such excessive limitation of the right to freedom of expression. And I would now like to hand over to my colleague Paul Coleman, where he will explain to you some of the cases we have been working on that involved such excessive forms of hate speech and limitations in Europe, and where we would like to indicate to you what it looks like and the potential consequences of such laws. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Georgia, and thank you, Honourable Members of Parliament, for allowing us to present to you this afternoon. As Georgia said, my name is Paul Coleman. I lead the work of ADF International. I'm a British solicitor. I've litigated a number of cases at the European Court of Human Rights, and for many years overseen our human rights work at the United Nations, both in New York and Geneva. I've also written extensively on the subject of hate speech laws in Europe and around the world. And it's with that background that I wanted to briefly share how these laws apply in practice, because just a few weeks ago, I was in Helsinki, Finland, involved in a criminal prosecution of a member of parliament, such as yourself, a grandmother of 10, a mother of 5, who faces 3 counts of hate speech for expressing her deeply held beliefs on issues related to marriage and human sexuality. And the case really illustrates what can happen when vaguely worded hate speech laws are brought into force. And so just very briefly, I will share my screen and just walk you through this case of Dr. Päivi Räsänen, one of the longest serving members of parliament in Finland. Dr. Räsänen wrote a booklet for her church, 18 pages or so, in 2004 on the topic of marriage and sexuality. And then 15 years after that, she sent a tweet of a picture of some Bible verses. It was directed towards the leadership of her church, and she questioned the church's decision to sponsor a Helsinki Pride Parade and asked essentially how this action of the church lines up with what she understands to be the teachings of Scripture. So I've put both of those on the screen, and the tweet, you can see that's all it is, a picture of some Bible verses and then a question about church doctrine. For that, she has gone through this whole ordeal of this criminal prosecution. It's 4 years and counting. It's been at least 13 hours of police interrogation, three criminal charges that she faces. A bishop who published the booklet in 2004 also faces criminal prosecution. There have been two court cases so far, one at the district court and now at the appeal court. So it's a huge cost in legal fees, as well as, of course, taxpayer money. And all of this stems from her action to take a picture of her Bible and post it to Twitter. And the case really illustrates what happens when these vague and subjective laws are brought into force. So I wanted to briefly share this case with you because it's live right now. We've been working on it for years, but it's one case of dozens and dozens that show how these vaguely worded hate speech laws work in practice. So along with my colleague Georgia, we encourage you to look particularly at section 4 of the bill and see how this wording can be significantly amended and tightened to protect the fundamental right to freedom of expression. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are you done with your presentation?
Yeah.
Okay. No. Thank you very much for that presentation and for bringing that international perspective into the picture. Our members, do you have any questions for clarity from Mr. Lockie?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, firstly, much to my surprise, Ms. du Plessis and I were at university when she was still Georgia Mayberg, I believe, in Bloemfontein. So it's quite a surprise to see her after many, many years. I hope you are well. Chairperson, just one or two questions. The previous speaker or the previous presentation that we heard indicated that, in his opinion, the concept of hate is almost impossible to define. Would you agree with it, or would you say that they are in the other bills in various other countries a definition of hate that would be suitable, that can be applied? Because if you sit with criminal law that is vaguely defined, as we know, it actually makes things much more difficult than to have a clearly defined one. So if Parliament does decide to go down that route of keeping the bill, it should at least be the elements of the crime should at least be very, very clearly defined. Has it been possible in other legislation to define this concept properly, and what would you propose in that regard? And then also just based on what Mr. Coleman said as the last point he made, that section 4, they suggest that it should be properly cleaned up and also defined quite clearly. In that sense, and we've asked other presentations to also, or other presenters to do the same, when you say that we should look at amending the current version of Section 4, what amendments would you suggest? And preferably, if you have a proposed wording that could give effect to that for us to at least consider as a basis to work from. But I would very much like to just get some clarity on what you have in mind when you make that proposal. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Nicolakis. Maybe I could just add a question as well. Just in terms of your experience or in your engagements in some of these cases, Perhaps what has been some of the difficulties in identifying whether there's sufficient evidence to prove? I think it's an issue that you do raise in your submission as well. But if you could just maybe elaborate, you know, a bit on that matter. Thank you. Over to yourself.
Thank you.
I'm not sure whether who's responding yet.
I tell you what, I'll dive in, and then Georgia, you add if I may. There is no universally agreed definition of hate or hate speech, and so that's not just my opinion, but I think if you search for one, many documents that are written on this subject begin by saying there is no universally agreed definition of hate or hate speech. From my perspective, it is not only undefined, but it is undefinable in law, and certainly criminal law, when we're looking for the tightest wording possible so people can regulate their behavior and know if they're on the right or the wrong side of the law. But hate is by its nature, subjective. It is, and if we take the case of Päivi Räsänen, she finds it offensive that what she said is referred to as hatred, because from her perspective, she's acting out of love. And from someone else's perspective, they consider it to be hate. Now, who decides? Who adjudicates that? Of course, then it's left to the courts, it's left to the police, it's left to the prosecutors to decide. But what one person considers hate, someone else might consider to be love or any number of other things. So it is impossible, I think, to narrow down a tight definition of it. Now, what we see in other legislation is either sidestepping the issue completely. And I think, honestly, in this bill, Section 1 referring to 4.1 and then essentially just creating a circular definition that hate speech is propagating hatred is something that we see quite common. Or the other thing that we see is various synonyms are used in lieu of a definition. And so hatred is insult, hatred is something offensive or what have you. But again, synonyms of hatred, but not getting further towards definition. Regarding this section, I think that as Georgia pointed out, there is nothing here in terms of intentionality, and so that could certainly be introduced. I think the wording from Article 20, subsection 2 of the ICCPR, and also the International Covenant on the Eradication of Racial Discrimination, ICERD, both include the concept of incitement. And I think incitement could be included here as well. So that would be two things that would tighten the wording. And then the third would be Section 4, Subsection 2, which essentially is a clarifying section within the bill, explaining what is not going to be caught by this. And again, the wording there could be tightened to support and strengthen freedom of expression. And we would be very happy to make those submissions in a written form. If it would be helpful by way of follow-up. And then, the final thing in regard to evidence to convict, but the reality is that most of the way that these hate speech cases are litigated don't involve a victim, and they don't involve evidence. I've sat through 4 years of the Päivi Räsänen trial, and there are no witnesses. There is no victim as such. What happens is the state prosecutor is the one who determines whether or not certain words are offensive and brings the prosecution even without a victim. And that's what we see in a lot of different jurisdictions. George, I'm sure if you would like to add to that.
Yes, thank you, Honourable Member Michalakis. And yes, I remember you very well at university. Thank you for the acknowledgement. Just as to your question about whether there exists such a definition, the United Nations Strategy and Plan of Action on Hate Speech, so the actual United Nations Plan of Action on Hate Speech, even quote, and I'm quoting what they said, they clearly stated, and I quote, there is no international legal definition of hate speech, and the characterization of what is hateful is controversial and disputed. So this is by the United Nations Plan of Action on Hate Speech. And furthermore, from a European Union level, to the extent that it is relevant, we do find one attempt at a definition in Article 1 of the framework decision. But this article comes defines hate speech as publicly incitement to violence or hatred. Again, that circular argument, hate speech is incitement to hatred, which is, again, a very broad and undefined attempt at a definition. And then, in our international research, from an international law perspective, there's a clear acknowledgement from the United Nations that there is no universal definition, there is no clear definition of hate speech. And secondly, when an attempt is made, it's similar to what happens in the South African bill, and this is this circular argument that hate speech is incitement to hatred. And what that means is open to subjective interpretation. That is all that I have to add to the answers of Mr. Coleman. Thank you.
Okay, no, thanks very much. Thank you very much for the responses. You did mention you would want to supplement some information to us. You may do so, and I think if we could get it by the end of next week, Wednesday, so we could use the week to try and make that submission. Okay. Let me thank you very much for your presentation as well as for your response to members' questions. Thank you. We will take other processes forward as the committee.
Thank you.
Members, we'll then move on to the the next presentation, which is by the hate crime working group. We have, I think it's Katleho Sipho Tokele. Katleho, are you on the platform?
Yes, I am. I can hear you. I have my
I cannot see you, but can other members see Ms. Katleho? I don't think we can see you, but let me welcome you. Thank you and your organization for making an input into the hate crimes, hate speech bill. And thank you for accepting this opportunity to do an oral presentation based on your written ones. As I've indicated, I don't know how long you've been on the platform, but you have 15 minutes to make your presentation. And if you could please focus on what your issues are with the ball and what your recommendations are. Over to you.
Okay, I'm going to try and share screen.
Okay, I think you have a code. Yeah, you should be able to do that now.
Am I able to do that?
Yes, you are.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's go here. Are you able to see my screen?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Let me do this. Okay, I am Katleho Sipho Tokele from the Hate Crimes Working Group. As you can see on your screen, these are the organizations represented in their logos. Just a brief background. So the Hate Crimes Working Group is a multi-sectoral network of civil society organizations, and private individuals set up to spearhead advocacy and reform initiatives pertaining to hate crimes in South Africa and the region. Members of the network work in diverse sectors, namely in LGBTIQ+, and sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, sex characteristics rights, so GS rights, sex worker rights, migrant, refugee and asylum seeker rights. Religious organizations are also reflected, academic and research entities, gender-based entities, and broader human rights organizations. All our members combined have extensive track records and advocacy work in these and focus areas. We share common concerns regarding the impact of hate crimes in South Africa from the perspective of victims or from a legal service provision, research-based and or advocacy perspective. I'll get a little bit into our brief history. In February 2018, the working group, the hate crimes working group, launched its hate and bias crime monitoring report. The report captured the findings of a longitudinal research study from 2013 to 2017 in five provinces of South Africa to gauge the types, nature, and impact of hate crimes perpetrated against individuals and communities in those provinces, namely the Eastern Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, and Western Cape. We're also happy to share that longitudinal research study. Later the same year, on 13 April, the first provincial and combating of hate crimes and hate speech bill, the bill, was introduced to the National Assembly. So that is just a little bit of background and history. So this is the overview of our oral submissions today. We'll be talking on, you know, suggested additions to the definition section, which is section one, a new sort of notice period and legal obligations that we examine under section three, new section, section 4.3, and we'll also be reflecting on the victim impact statement inclusion, section 5. The fifth item would be reporting on the implementation of the Act, section 8. In section 6, we'll be talking about the prevention of hate crime and hate speech. We'll be examining section 9 briefly, also looking into cross elements. So in our first submission would be suggested additions to the definitions section, which is section 1. We would like to include definitions associates and secondly look into the term bona fide. With associates, here I would suggest inclusion of the term associates so that it defines associates in this definition section defined as family members who wish for it to be defined as family members, colleagues, friends, and other possible connections to a victim. It is important to define this term given its used in section on victim impact statements. We also suggest using the term associates in the section setting out the elements of hate crime and hate speech, which is section 3 and section 4. It is simpler to read and can be used as a casual phrase, listing all possible connections to the victim and relevant section, the relevant section. We also look into the term bona fide as one to be included in section 1. While this term is easily understood by legal practitioners, it is not a common term in everyday parlance, so we submit that its use in section 4.2 of the bill requires that it either be added to the definition section of the bill or replaced with a more commonly understood term, good faith. And now we'll move to section 3. We note in terms of section 3.1, we are broadly supportive of the framing of this offence, including the listed grounds and characteristics. But however, in terms of section 3, subsection 3, we support the contemplated role of the Director of Prosecution in this section. However, additionally, we would like to submit that there should be an express legal obligation on the Director of Public Prosecutions or their delegates to provide written reasons to a complainant or the associate within 3 working days when a decision has been taken to decline to prosecute a charge of a hate crime. This can be achieved with the addition of a new section, section 3, subsection 4, as proposed below. So it would read the proposed section, subsection 4, where the director of public prosecution or person delegated by them declines to prosecute a charge of hate crime. Written reasons for this decision must be provided to the complainant or the associates within 3 working days. We further note that the definition of working days would need to be included in section one, the definition section. In this regard, we note that working days, or we also submit that working days would refer to any other day other than a Saturday, Sunday, and or public holiday. We wish to create this legal sort of obligation of written reasons within three working days, because we would also like to create an environment of sort of legal transparency and also levels of legal certainty so that people are able to know also, you know, when the reasons why prosecutions was declined, and also to facilitate an environment where there is at least a speedy sort of prosecution around these matters, particularly where there's been a decline to prosecute. We believe that there should be enough transparency for that to be communicated and that to be done in a speedy. And then with regards to section 4.3, we would like to reiterate our submissions around section 3, subsection 3, which in subsection 4.3, it now speaks to the elements of hate speech. So again, here we submit that where the prosecution declines a charge of hate speech, there should be an express legal obligation on the director of public prosecution or their delegate to provide a complainant or the associates with written reasons within three working days. Again, here also the same reasons also apply. Also, you know, defining the working days as any other day than a Saturday, Sunday, or a public holiday. So also similar to section 3, we wish to just, you know, there be a legal duty on part of prosecution to provide written reasons for declining within three working days, also to ensure speedy resolution. And then here we come to section 5. We are definitely encouraged by the provision that requires victims authorization when a person other than the victim is making a victim impact statement. However, we wish to point out that the nature of hate crimes in South Africa at times regularly leads to the death of the victim. In other words, a victim may not be able to either make a victim impact statement themselves or indeed authorize anyone else to do so on their behalf. So because we know that hate crimes are a message crime, and while they may be an individual victim of the crime, the impact is also felt by the community and groups to which they belong. So here, for this reason, we submit that a prosecutor should be empowered by the bill to obtain expert input on the victim impact statements from interest groups and organizations who work directly with the community or group to which the victims belong. We believe that this will greatly help courts understand the impact of hate crime, not only on individual victims and the associates, but the broader group and community to which the victim belongs, especially if the hate crime has caused a victim's death. So here again, we also wish to create a mechanism where, in the event where the victim has died, we have a mechanism where their voices can still be heard. So we believe that this is appropriate and necessary, given that hate crimes are messes crimes spread through fear and affect equality and dignity of entire populations of communities and groups of people. So with this regard, we'd like to submit that section 1 should be reworded as follows. So for the purposes of this section, a victim impact statement means a sworn statement or affirmation by one or more of the following persons. One, the victim. Two, someone authorized by the victim to make such a statement on behalf of the victim. Three, in the event, so this is what we propose, in the event of the victim's death, the victims' associates through an organization or institution with expert knowledge or experience of the group to which the victim belongs or is deceived to belong, which contains the physical, psychological, social, economic, or any other consequences of the offense for the victim and the associate. So here again, inclusion of who, you know, who can make also the victim impact statement. So we would like also to open it to organizations, institutions with expert knowledge or experience. So in the case of an LGBTI person, an organization that works with LGBTI people can be of assistance to support. I just want to check with colleagues, are you able to see my PowerPoint?
Well, from my side, I can see it, but it's not moving, but I've also been having a bit of network challenges.
Well, it's not moving.
So from my side, I'm not sure, honorable members, if you're having the same challenge as I am.
No,
it's just been stuck on section
it's
5.
Been on section 5.
Are you all on section 5?
All of us are on section 5. Okay. We're not from section 5.
Okay, right. I think we're still good. I thought you were not, you know, because if you see section 5, that means you can see we are moving. Okay.
No, Katlego, you're not understanding. Since the beginning of your talk, it has been on one page, so it has not moved at all. So we have not been able to follow along with what you are saying.
Okay,
it's fine. Ma'am, let me deal with this. Thank you very much, Ms. Lisko. Yeah, yes, I know that I didn't raise it because I've been having a bit of network issues, so I thought it was stuck on my side. But be that as it may, you may continue from where you are. I'm not sure why your slides, your screen's not moving, but we do also have your written submission with us. So please continue.
Okay. So yes, to include organizations and institutions. So we also looked into section 5.2. We are encouraged that the bill creates an obligation on prosecutors to provide written reasons to the court in the absence of a victim impact statement from the victim. However, we are concerned, as noted with the previous section, that is only limited to that of a victim. So again, we are concerned in a situation where the victim has passed on, is dead. Include also organizations and institutions with expert knowledge or experience to also be included with the purposes also of the victim impact statement. So in this regard, we submit that the VIS must also extend to, in the event of the victim's death, the victim's associate, an organization or institution with expert knowledge or experience of the group to which the victim belongs or is perceived to belong. Further, in this regard, we also propose the following subsection 5, subsection 3, which can be added as follows. Where it is not possible to obtain a victim impact statement provided in subsection 1, the prosecutor must provide the court with written reasons for the absence of such a statement by either the victim, the associate, and this is what we propose, or an organization or institution with expert knowledge or experience of the group to which the victim belongs or is perceived to belong. And then we'll go to subsection 8, which speaks to the reporting on the implementation of the Act. We support the provisions of section 8. However, we submit, due to the public interest nature of hate crimes and hate speech in South Africa, Section 8, subsection 2, must be equally extended to the public. Therefore, the information contemplated by Section 8, subsection 1, must be available to the South African public. In this regard, we submit the following inclusion must be made with regards to that provision. The provision reads that the information contemplated in subsection 1 must be made available in the prescribed manner and at the prescribed time to Parliament, the chairperson of the South African Human Rights Commission, C, the chairperson of the Commission for Gender Equality, and the chairperson of the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights, Cultural and Religious, so CRL Commission. We would like to propose the fifth one, which will be public, South African public. We believe that, you know, it's supported by the bill. And lastly, we'd like to talk to refer to section 9. We support the provisions of section 9. However, we'd like to suggest that adequate funding is allocated to strengthen the work of the awareness campaigns and trainings of officials. We'd also implore that experts in sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics should be consulted alongside with civil society organizations with experience in these areas. And also this will include, you know, other sort of interested groups, you know, refugees, migrants, asylum seekers, et cetera. So this also brings us to also the costing of a bill, which we believe would be great for greater accountability. We note that while various versions of the bill have been available since 2006, the bill remains uncosted. We note with concern the general poor implementation that generally plagues many South African laws. We are simply would like to submit that we are deeply concerned that the lack of costing means that the bill may suffer also the same fate. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sipotekele, for that presentation. Honourable Members, are there any questions? Are there any questions for clarity?
I'm more than happy to
Honourable Baden.
Sorry?
Honourable Badenhorst, if you could ask your question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity. I note that Ms. Sipokutele, that your grouping says that it supports the stated objects of the bill. I would just like to ask you the one of the main objects of this bill is to criminalize hate speech. But in the definitions of this bill, it only indicates a definition for harm, and it doesn't indicate any definition for hate or hatred. What is your take on that? Have you got any viewpoint or whether that makes this bill a legitimate bill or not? I appreciate your input. Thank you very much.
Sure, I think it does make it a legitimate bill.
Thank you very much, Honourable
Ballinghouse. If I understood your question correctly, I think that the bill is relevant in the South African context. I believe that, you know, that it's important that this bill gets passed so that, you know, we test its utility, particularly with the growing, you know, climate of intolerance in South Africa. I believe that, you know, the bill can create a mechanism in which we're able to deal with hate-related crimes. And I believe that even though in legal technical terms it might be difficult for us to come to some particular agreement in terms of, you know, what constitutes hate, and be happy with a very pure universal declaration, I think that this bill should be passed and we should be able to be afforded, it should be able to be afforded, you know, to be tested in practice, because I think that there is the climate of intolerance and hate does necessitate that we do something about it. So I think that definitely there is relevance.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ms. Kipote Kele. Honourable members, I think we'll move to the next presenter. Thank you very much, Ms. Kipote Kele. I'm sorry, when you said that you could provide us with your presentation, I think I interrupted you at some point. You can just provide secretariat. I think that would be appreciated.
Okay.
But we don't dictate how you should present to us. You can even talk to us as members.
Okay.
But we do have your written submission. But let me thank you once again for the submission and for responding to questions.
Thank you. I'll share the presentation accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On this, we'll then move on to the next presenter. Presentation. All right. It's the International Religious Freedom Roundtable. I would imagine Africa. I have two names on this program. We have an Honorable Rolling A. and Brookhoven and Ms. Simon Miller. I see Honorable Rolling van Brookhoven is on the platform. Welcome to this session. We've received your written submission as well as we credit that you accepted to make an oral submission to the committee. We'll be giving 15 minutes at least to make your input, and thereafter members will interact with your input. Let me then hand over to yourself, but we could focus on what your issues are with the bill and what your proposed recommendations are.
Sure. Thank you very much, Your Honor, Ms. Sheikh, Committee Chairperson, and the Honorable Members of the Select Committee on Security and Justice, Parliament of the Republic of South Africa. Thank you for this opportunity to meet with you on such a significant bill. It is with great honor and privilege that I've been invited to address you regarding this bill, the amendment to the Prevention and Combating Hate Crimes and Hate Speech. I am Judge Rollin A. van Brookhoven of Washington, D.C., now a retired federal judge, and am active in civil society as a law professor in China for jurisprudence, constitutional law, human rights, international religious freedom. For the last 15 years, I've been active member of the International Religious Freedom Roundtable based in Washington, D.C., which is composed of religious freedom advocates from around the world. We meet weekly to discuss laws and practices from around the world, and at least once a month with the U.S. Ambassador for International Religious Freedom and senior government officials. I'm also on the board of directors of the Institute for Global Engagement. I was raised in Guatemala, and it was there where I first became aware of the importance of freedom of religion of all religious groups, and thus started my global engagement in society on this very subject. Moreover, I came to understand that the dignity of human beings required such protection, since we are all created in the image of God with free will. I was last in Cape Town at the invitation Mr. Michael Swain and Ms. Daniela Ellenbeck at the Sub-Saharan Summit on the Rule of Law and Freedom of Religion, South Africa. It was at that summit, made up of leaders of religious freedom, civil society, and some members of South African Parliament, that I became aware of this bill, or the B version of the Prevention and Combating of Hate Crime and Hate Speech. The threat that it posed to South Africans' right to religious freedom, particularly with respect to its proposed maximum jail sentence of 8 years, even for the first offense. My sense is that none of us who are representatives from multiple international organizations and actively engaged would be protected from such jail sentence. As a scholar and professor of jurisprudence, I have long held the belief that law is pre-political, that is, that the basic rights and obligations of law existed prior to the existence of government. I believe that this is consistent with the declaration and elimination of intolerance and discrimination based on religion or belief, proclaimed by the General Assembly and ultimately embedded in the Charter of the United Nations. Indeed, Article 1 proclaims this right of freedom of thought, conscience, or religion, includes the freedom to have such a belief or religion, either individually or in community with others, and in private or in public, and to manifest that belief or religion in worship, observance, practice, and teaching. Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, quote, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in the spirit of brotherhood. The question that this version of Bill 89B, the hate crime, hate speech bill, presents to me is whether or not we are endowed with reason and conscience so that we are encouraged to act toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood. My prayer is that its final version and it's enacted in law, that it will do just that. Section 15 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa clearly affirms the fundamental right of freedom of conscience, religion, thought, belief, and opinion. Notwithstanding the clarity of this language in many constitutions around the world, we know that these protections are violated in the court of one's practice of its conscience, religion, thought, or belief and opinion. For those of us who think theologically, we attribute both the need for such political protection as well as the failures on the part of the government and public due to the fall or original sin. But the alleged failure on the part of the public occurs largely due either to the government or public objection to the practice of one's faith, religion, or belief. Thus, what is really protected in such laws is the private opinion or belief held by the practitioner, not the living out of that belief or faith in practice that may be consistent with the belief or religion. The South African Constitution and various international agreements to which it is committed require South Africa to uphold the right of freedom of expression and the right of freedom of religion. As a stranger to your country, I also, as a former United States judge who has practiced international law for over 55 years, it appears to me that the bill can be read so widely that it would result in South Africa's failure to meet its obligations under international law. My judicial philosophy and method of interpretation has always been what we call in the United States as an originalist. That is, words mean something. When words are so fluid in statute or in our system or in common law where we rely on precedents such as I have, they simply lose their original meaning. Thus, one of the purposes of law is to be predictive and instructive, not only to judges and lawyers, but to the population generally who are bound by those words. The wide definition of hate speech in this bill is wider than required by your Constitution and by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenants on Human Rights. Enforcement of this bill would result in could result in South Africa's violation of those principles of non-discrimination and equality before the law, and the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion, and belief. Further, your Constitution contains four grounds for hate speech: race, ethnicity, gender, and religion. As we have seen in the United States, these terms are fluid. While race and ethnicity are still quite firm, gender has been moved from a biologically and grammatically based term to one that is sociologically determined by individuals or claimed to be in biological transition, with some 90 plus genders now from which they can choose. Similarly, religion has lost some of its identity to the point now where the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, seem to be the prevailing non-aligned religious preference. As a practicing religious adherent and lawyer, it is objectionable to me to have any such limitations, including religious expression based on centuries or even thousands. It is with sadness that I acknowledge that in the U.S. and around the world, traditional religious views which have been held for centuries, such as marriage, sexuality, and gender, which I
recording in progress.
As human beings functioning in a free and democratic society. While I make no pretense to be familiar with South African law and society, as an outsider, I urge the select committee to seriously consider the concerns of those who have spoken here today and will speak, especially those far more familiar with the legal and social framework of South Africa, some of whom I know. Moreover, as a believer and a religious practitioner, I am especially concerned about how this amendment would affect those of us who are committed both to our faith and to civil society. It is important to us, not just to be citizens of South Africa, to understand that our religious freedoms and obligations are protected from any threat of criminal sanctions, although by conscience we might have to experience such a sanction. I thank you for this opportunity to express myself to you on these matters. As a stranger to your country, but one who has been there a number of times, I love South Africa and wish the best for it and its people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Van Broekhoven, for your presentation. Honorable members, are there any questions for clarity? Honorable Mikolaki?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation, Judge Van Broekhoven. The question that I'm going to ask, I'm not quite sure whether the legal system in the United States is comparable to South Africa's in the same way that the UK's is, but I hope you will be able to help me with some of the questions that I have. The first one is that we have heard from earlier speakers that it's difficult to define the concept of hate legally. And if it cannot be defined, would it not be, some would argue that if you can't define a specific concept in a criminal statute, that it almost becomes either uninterpretable, so no one would know before they are in trouble that they have actually committed a crime, or that it would be left open to the courts to interpret it, which is also, according to some of the persons we've heard, problematic. The same goes for the current definition that this bill has for harm. We heard yesterday from a university professor who said that she'd prefer the definition of harm to be as wide as possible so that the courts can add flesh to it. I would just like to hear your opinion on that. In my opinion, when criminal law is made, the definitions have to be very, very clear beforehand so that everyone knows exactly what it is that they can and cannot do. It can't be decided when you're in court only. But I would like to hear your opinion on that. Then the second one is some of the arguments with regards to the 8 years maximum sanction that you have mentioned are that this is only a maximum sanction and that it can be much, much less. So we need not worry about an 8 year maximum sanction. That's only reserved for the most serious cases. And I would like to hear your opinion on that as well. Then, yes, I was covered by those two. The third one that I want to ask you is, we have heard an earlier argument that the Section 4, Subsection 2D gives exemption to persons on the basis of religion. Now, whether it does so, whether that section is perfect or not, we'll still debate. There are questions about that. But one of the arguments were made that on a constitutional basis, it's questionable because certain rights like that should not only be afforded to persons based on their religion, but also to persons who might not be religious. They should be afforded the same right to express themselves in that way. And therefore, due to the fact that that exemption excludes a big segment of or a segment of society, it should also be considered unconstitutional. So those are the three aspects of the bill which I would very much like to hear your opinion on and your perspective as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think to a certain extent, I addressed one or two of them in my initial remarks, although very briefly. I'm an originalist, and I believe that words in statutes or regulations mean something. And when they do not mean what they purport to mean, people in the general public are prone to be subject to criminal prosecution or criminal procedures. To that extent, I, as an originalist, I don't think that judges have complete discretion to decide what words mean or what they do not mean in constitution or in by a statute. I think there's probably a little more discretion in regulatory language. But for the most part, I agree that if somebody is to be held accountable for violating a law, that law should be clear enough for them to know that they are violating it. So that, I think, covers most of your first question. Is that correct?
Thank you very much, yes.
Okay. Your second question, I think probably is a little broader. And maybe I'm jumping to the third. I believe we all have these rights and they are applied equally. That's why I mentioned the sociological studies of religious and beliefs and opinions on the basis of nuns. There are a lot of people in the United States that do not want to declare themselves as non-believers. So they simply identify themselves as not holding to a particular religion or belief. And those have been generally described as nuns or N-O-N-E-S. My sense is that the nuns are entitled to all the rights that those of any religious group adhere to. I think that's part of humanness. It's part of the dignity of the human person. And my personal belief is, unless it is openly harmful, it's not something that should be prosecuted criminally. If there is an issue with it, there are civil laws in most countries that address that issue. Now, what I have discovered in China is the government largely dictates what the belief system is. Just as an aside, the government dictated, the Communist Party dictated some time ago that crosses must come down from behind the altars. And there was resistance among the registered churches. The unregistered churches or house churches generally are illegal anyway, and they ignore all of this. But when President Xi Jinping issued that order, for those churches that refused to take the crosses down, he required a portrait of Mao Zedong on one side of the cross and Xi Jinping on another. And when I spoke to the head of the Religious Affairs Bureau about who came up with that idea, I said, did you not know that those were two thieves on either side of the cross? And so that has kind of been picked up by a number of people over there. The church I attend in Beijing has its cross still behind the altar and no portraits. So my sense is that we are free to believe and all of us should be treated equally. Now, I forget your second question, and I think I omitted it. What was the second question?
You, if I may?
Yes, please, Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. No, the second question was very much the second question was the one about the 8 years maximum sentence, that the argument from some that it's only a maximum sentence.
Well, that may very well be. And as I said, I am not really knowledgeable about either the workings of your juridical system, but my guess is that if you leave it up to judges, we tend to be arbitrary. And some of our arbitrariness comes from public view. And my sense is frequently, to put it in your context, that 8-year sentence depends on more than simply the practicing of one's belief or what one's belief system is. It may apply to issues of ethnicity, background, history. You've got a history that I have followed fairly closely for 40 years, I guess. And my guess is that if you're prone to have a judge that is reasonably arbitrary and has not completely emotionally and intellectually moved away from that history, the punishments would be uneven, notwithstanding the fact that, as you point out, it's an 8-year maximum. Whether that becomes a maximum for a first offense, or the nature of the offense, or whether it becomes a maximum in terms of just some other grounds, political pressure, I don't know. My guess is that is a bit of a red herring for those that are interested in pushing the bill. And I respect South Africa's ability to promote its own laws consistent with its history and background. And so anything I say is not critical about that. But we as humans tend to do what we do without regard to what our background is. And so I would say that the 8-year maximum may or may not be a true picture of what the bill would ultimately promote.
Now, thank you very much, Honorable Judge, for your responses to those questions. Let me also thank you and your institution for making also an input into this poll. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
much appreciated. Members, we'll move on to the next presenter or presentation. It's the Orem Institute. Ms. Maria Sibagnoni, are you on the platform?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Welcome to this public hearing. I think we should also thank you for your input into this bill, as well as your presence today to make this presentation. We will be giving you 15 minutes to do that, and if you could please focus on what your issues are in relation to the bill, as well as what recommendations that you may have. Please, over to you.
Thank you very much to the Select Committee for inviting us as Orem into this important platform, you know, for us to engage with the hate crime bill. Can I check, can you see my screen?
No, we just see you.
Oh, okay. Let's try again. Did you give me the right to share?
Yeah, you do have those.
Okay, let me see now. Are you able to see my screen now?
No, we cannot. But you're welcome to continue with your presentation because we do have your submission.
Okay, perfect. So my name is Maria Sibagnoni. I am the Senior Technical Advisor for Key Population at Orem Institute. We are based in Johannesburg. And our submission was focusing on corrective rape. Therefore, my presentation will be really talking to corrective rape. Just to give you a bit of background about who is Orem, Orem is an African organization that was founded in 1998 with the aim of improving global health in research, and the research is done in many fields. We're also supporting Department of Health in systems strengthening and service delivery, focusing on HIV and TB. Sorry. In terms of the operational activities, the organization is led by expert of international teams that is managing all of these multinational projects. We have footprints in Ghana, Mozambique, and South Africa. So in October 2019, Orem then introduced the POP-IN clinics. These clinics are funded by CDC, and they are catering to the specialized health needs of the LGBTQIA plus community. And our focus is more or specifically on men who have sex with men and transgender women. And we are currently working at Eshanzeni, eThekwini, Tswane, and Ekuruleni. So these clinics, they provide comprehensive package of services that includes psychosocial support and health, sexual health care services. Now, when we look at the bill that we are talking about today, it is a very critical issue that demands everyone's attention. So by supporting this bill, we are sending a very strong message that hate has no place in our society. So therefore, this calls all community to stand together and ensure that justice is served for all the hate crime victims. Corrective rape is a serious crime, and its actions qualifies as a hate crime because of the violent behavior of the rapist. We have actually read and we've received report on how the victims were gang raped, you know, victims were brutally assaulted, and how they were killed in a barbaric way. South Africa has been experiencing a series of these incidences of rape, and in which LGBTQIA are targeted and they're often murdered. So therefore, corrective rape is a matter of agency. Fundamentally, if we look at the corrective rape, it has got two dimensions. The first one being it's a violence against women. And as a country, we are currently sitting with a high rate of gender-based violence, you know, that we are facing as a country. And this adds to that, you know, incidences. And the other one is the homophobia. You know, despite the fact that our constitution, you know, accommodates and sexual orientation is enshrined in our constitution, but we still find people that are homophobic. So corrective rape, it needs to be classified as a hate crime. If we look at the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Dismissal Act of 2000, it prohibits the hate crime that is committed amongst people of a specific group. Therefore, our basis is then on that, you know, act to say that this corrective rape needs to be classified as a hate crime. Currently, if we look at the state of what is happening with the LGBTQIA Black community in South Africa, we've got a beautiful constitution that is progressive. You know, it actually guarantees the right to equality and prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation. But despite everything, you know, in our constitution, we still face with the problem of homophobia. There are lots of incidents of corrective rape amongst lesbians in South Africa in the recent years. And having worked with the LGBTQI communities, we also receive a report that it's not only lesbians, it's also transgender women and men who have sex with men who actually, they also experience the same corrective, you know, rape incidences. So the problem is broader than the lesbians. It's wide. Although South Africa has come from a most progressive legislation, like I said, I've quoted the constitution pertaining to LGBTQIA community, many still feel mistreated by community. They feel unaccepted. They are stigmatized. They are humiliated. They are hated to the core. It's actually unbelievable. Now, in South Africa, it is believed that lesbians from African communities are the most prone to fall prey to this crime. And this is due to their cultural environment. Because in African countries, we've got this value system. And those value systems, they're prescriptive in a way of how a woman should carry themselves and how they should uphold themselves. And those values, they actually are the ones who are exacerbating the incidence of corrective rape, because if a woman doesn't conform to those norms and values, then they are seen as social deviants. The intention coupled with violent behavior of the rapist may qualify the action of action as a hate crime. However, what is worrying and also what is of concern, the bill is not clear and does not mention or even categorize the corrective rape. It could be useful for the bill to examine the current legal position regarding the corrective rape and how it actually shapes the norms regarding the sexual orientation. It is furthermore questioned whether corrective rape, should it be classified as a hate crime? You know, because when we actually went through the bill and we didn't see anything that is addressing the corrective rape that is so crucial and important in our LGBTI communities and the community at large, we have seen that there is a big gap there. So therefore, the question that needs to be raised at this point, I guess, is whether South African legal framework, does it adequately addresses the scourge of corrective rape in the light of the aims of transformation of our constitution? So therefore, as Oram, we really feel strong that corrective rape should be really be categorized as a hate, as a hate crime. And we feel strongly about that. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sibanioni, for the presentation and raising those issues. I'm just going to, our members, are there any questions that you want to ask for clarity? I think the proposal made was quite clear around the inclusion of corrective rape as a hate crime. Are there any questions of clarity? Okay, if there are none, let me thank you very much, Ms. Sibanioni and your institute, the Oram Institute, for making this input into this bill, as well as coming to present to the committee today. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, our members will then move on to the next presentation. From the, is it the Film and Publication Board? Yes, Mr. Andrew Sivaku, are you on the platform?
Yeah, Honorable Chair, can I just request that maybe the next presenter, you know, present, because, Dr. Mashilo Buluka, who is going to do the presentation, was, just held up, especially after, you know, we had to be disconnected, but then he is connecting. So if the next presenter can just, present, and then I will let you know as soon as he is connected.
Okay, thank you very much. Is Mr. Pierre Broad present or on the platform from PASPA?
Chairperson, Mr. Duan was only able to come at that specific time. I'm wondering if we could move to the next.
Is Ms. Kim, or Ms. Kim Lefkow, I think you are present. Okay, from same Toti Love, Ms. Lefkow, welcome to the platform. Are you on the platform? Ms. Lefkow, are you on the platform? Kishan, I'm not getting Ms. Lefkow. All right, I'm not sure which, because the next one asked same Love Turkey is the Scalabrini Center of Cape Town, Mr. James Chapman. Okay, I don't think he's on the platform. Is Dale Wallace on the platform? All right. And then there's Mr. Matthew Cuthbert from the Democratic Alliance. Okay, and I know they should be for much later. All right, members, looks like we're going to perhaps, Kishan, I don't know if you're able to make a follow-up with anybody that's on the platform. They might not be, they might be waiting for their time. Yeah.
I will follow up after.
So from the Film and Publications Board, I guess you were scheduled at 4. the time now. Okay, I see you quite we picked up the pace. All right. Honourable, what do you say? You take a tea break? Are we lucky?
Sure, I just wanted to say a smoke break / tea break would be very, very welcome.
Tea break, yeah. For most of us that don't smoke. Look, I propose that it's 3:30. Can we maybe take a 10-minute break? And in the meantime, Gershon, perhaps can maybe make a follow up with any one of these institutions if they can be available, and maybe give us feedback thereafter. So a 10-minute break, I think, would be quite good for all of us. Remember, it's oh man, my watches, all of them are giving me different time. It's 25 to, so at 1:45, can we all then reconvene?
Thank you, Chair.
Recording stopped.
Gershon, I'm just checking in if the Philemon Publication Board is ready, or should we move on to the next one?
If we may move to the next one while the CEO is getting ready.
Okay. Okay. I think Ms. Kim Lithgow, you are on the platform.
Yes, I am.
Are you willing to go with your presentation now?
Yes, I can do that.
You can do that. Okay, before that, on members, are we back? Are we back in the meeting? It's past quarter two. I think members are yeah. Okay. Okay, let's go. Thank you very much. Your input is from an organization called Same Love Tilti. I hope I'm pronouncing it properly.
That's great. Yes.
Let me take this opportunity. Okay. Let me take this opportunity to thank you for your input, as well as for coming to the committee to make an oral presentation. I know you've been in the meeting for a while. We'll give you 15 minutes to make your presentation. And if you could please maybe focus on what your issues are with the hate crime hate speech bill, as well as what recommendations you'd like to make. Over to you, Mom.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to deliver the oral presentation.
Recording in progress.
The hate crime and hate speech bill. You should all have a copy of the Progressive Cruise Report and the Hate Crimes Working Group Advocacy Brief of 2022. I will be referring to statistics in those documents. So my name is Kim Lithgow. I'm founder and CEO of Same Love Tilti, a registered human rights-based non-profit organization that is dedicated to advancing LGBTQ rights in South Africa while offering support to sexual and gender diverse minorities and their families. I am the co-chair of the Hate Crimes Working Group, the member of the Gender Diversity Coalition, the Social Inclusion and Education Working Group, and other coalitions that strive to foster equality and inclusivity in South Africa. In July this year, I also delivered a statement to the United Nations on the inclusion and safety of LGBT in relation to the Sustainable Development Goals. So, regarding this bill that we're looking at today, I think it's important to acknowledge that in South Africa, hate crimes happen. Hate crimes happen in South Africa, hate speech happens in South Africa, and that is why we need to make it a crime to commit a hate crime or hate speech. Delaying hate crime legislation makes us the most hypocritical country. We are so proud of our progressive constitution that prohibits discrimination, making us a leader in Africa and far ahead of many other countries. But we have yet to criminalize the most extreme expression of discrimination, in other words, hate crime and hate speech. We cannot be satisfied with current legislation that has resulted in a few convictions, when we know that 80% of all LGBT hate crimes are not reported. We also know that 3 million people have openly admitted that they might in the future be violent towards LGBTI. And more than 1.5 million openly admitted to hate crime and hate speech against LGBT individuals. And this is why we need to pass this hate crime and hate speech bill as soon as possible. It is long overdue. We have had research on hate crime and hate speech from 2009. We've been working on this for ever since then, So now in 2023, it is long overdue that we actually implement this bill. Hate crime legislation safeguards the fundamental human rights of all individuals, especially when the majority fail to fully respect the rights of minorities. We are here debating the definition of hate, but hate crime victims do not debate the definition of hate. The definition of hate is written on their broken bodies. The definition of hate is written in their blood, their spilled blood. So go to the funerals, sit with their families, and that is where we will find the real definition of hate. Nonetheless, it's heartening for us to note that the majority of South Africans believe that lesbian women, gay men, transgender people, intersex individuals, and all sexual and gender diverse identities should enjoy the same human rights as everyone else, despite their differing views on same-sex relationships. And this is why we come before you today, to advocate for our basic human rights to live without fear or prejudice in a democratic society. Our freedoms come with obligations and responsibilities. In the past, many South Africans were denied their freedoms, so today we committed to upholding those freedoms. However, these freedoms need to also be respectful of people's dignity, equality, and freedom. If we look at freedom of speech, we know that offensive speech is not hate speech. No matter how many times the issue is raised, that offensive speech could land somebody in jail. Offensive speech is not hate speech, and this bill does not criminalize offensive speech. Hate speech, however, is perfectly defined by the Constitutional Court in the judgment against John Kwalani, and likewise in this bill. It's also fitting to remember that hate crimes are preceded by hate speech. Therefore, if we can curb hate speech, we can also curb the instance of hate crime. And likewise, if we can curb incitement to violence through hate speech, we can also curb hate crime. Freedom of expression is very similar. We are free to express ourselves, but we're not free to engage in hate speech or hate crime. We're free to express ourselves, but we may not violate the rights of others. Other people have the right to express themselves too, and again, we need to respect that right. Sorry. Freedom of religion. Freedom of religion does not mean the freedom to commit hate speech or the freedom to commit hate crimes. It is possible to speak about one's faith or belief system, respectfully acknowledging that others are free to make their own decisions, they are free to make their own choices, they are free to have their own faith and their own belief system. And simply respecting that does not dilute one's own freedom of religion. Respecting the dignity of someone who may or may not agree with you also does not restrict one's religious freedom. And acknowledging that others have a right to have their own beliefs does not dilute one's own faith. So I don't think that freedom of speech or freedom of expression or freedom of religion can be used as an excuse to not pass this bill. Finally, is this a perfect bill? No. It might not be perfect. There might be flaws, But none of the flaws are so grave that they would require us to delay passing this bill again. It's been 27 years since the adoption of the Constitution, and we are still grappling with discrimination. We are still having an escalation in hate crime and an escalation in hate speech. And after 27 years of trying other avenues to foster social inclusion and a live and let live attitude, it is now time to criminalize extreme forms of hate and violence and hate speech. This bill will save lives. It will uphold our own constitutional obligations. It will protect the freedom of minorities. And it will prevent hate crime and hate speech. It's imperative for the South African government to take a resolute stance against hate crimes and promptly enact this vital legislation. Hate crime legislation yields invaluable statistics, enabling us to craft effective strategies for preventing hate crimes, for raising awareness, for preventing intolerance, and curbing discrimination. This bill puts onus on state to provide training and raise awareness on the implementation of this bill. And it will also put onus on the state to access justice for the victims of hate crime and hate speech. As responsible citizens in a democratic nation, we wholeheartedly welcome a bill that is dedicated to preventing hatred, to preventing bias and discord amongst our people. We embrace a bill that promotes unity and respect for all individuals, combating violence that is rooted in discrimination and bias. It's a bill that can save lives and can encourage coexistence. It can build community. In a nation with a history marked by shameful discrimination, we bear the duty of ensuring that discrimination will never tarnish our future. And therefore, I implore Parliament to pass the Prevention and Combating of Hate Crime and Hate Speech Bill without delay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lithgow, for that presentation to the committee. Honourable members, are there any questions for clarity? Baba Mikolaki.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon, Ms. Lithgow. I think, Chairperson, it's important to start, firstly, thank you for the presentation. I think it's important to state, I can say this with confidence about my colleagues from all parties represented, and hate speech is not okay. Bigotry and homophobia is also not okay. But we are lawmakers, and it's our duty to make sure that the best law out there, or that the law that gets passed through Parliament is the best version of the law out there. So in the process where we ask these questions, we are seeking the best possible version of the bill, because bad law has serious negative consequences ultimately, and it doesn't go any far to really come up with solutions to serious social problems that we are facing. And this is a very serious social problem. And especially if you're dealing with criminal law, it needs to be very, very clearly defined, so that everyone knows what is allowed and what is not. So part of the questioning is very much based on trying to find a solution so we can put the best version of this bill out there. You have indicated that Kwelane was used in the Constitutional Court to put certain definitions or concepts out there. Would you say that the bill needs to be brought in line with what was stated in Kwelane?
Thank you,
and that it should bring that legal certainty. That would be my first question. My second one is, I am going to carry on about the definition of hate. I understand completely the argument that you made, but for purposes of the bill, we need to define it, in my opinion. And I would like to know, do you have some form of a definition that we can look at and to try to bring that legal certainty when we look at